Hello, this is Jane, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the November 20th issue of the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The first article I'm going to read is the headline across the front page, GTA Cocaine Lawyer Arrested. Brampton Man Faces Allegations of Advising Ex-Olympian Ryan Wedding to Murder FBI Witness. And this is by Calvi Leon and Peter Edwards. A GTA defense lawyer who posted about his successes under the social media handle at cocaine underscore line lawyer has been arrested on explosive U.S. allegations. He advised wanted drug lord and ex-Olympian Ryan Wedding to murder an FBI witness in Colombia. The arrest of Brampton lawyer Deepak Paredkar was announced as part of a sweeping set of new developments in the case against Wedding, who was labeled Canada's most prolific cocaine trafficker at a news conference in Washington, D.C. on Wednesday. Paredkar, who was described as Wedding's lawyer at the press conference, advised him to kill this witness, said Bill Esaly, the first assistant U.S. attorney at the Central District of California. Paredkar told Wedding, "If you kill this witness, the case will be dismissed," Esaly said. Wedding is responsible for a narco-terrorism program that we have not seen in a long time, FBI Director Kash Patel said. Patel called the Canadian a modern-day iteration of Pablo Escobar, while announcing the reward for his arrest has been raised to $15 million, that's U.S. dollars, from $10 million. On Wednesday, the FBI unsealed an indictment charging more than a dozen people, including a Toronto jeweler and a GTA blogger, with working for Wedding's alleged operation. Wedding himself faces a number of new charges, including conspiracy to commit the murder of the cooperating FBI witness, who was first identified by the Star as Jonathan Acevedo Garcia, 42. RCMP Commissioner Mike Duhame noted that seven Canadians have been arrested by the RCMP in coordination with the FBI. Fugitive Ryan Wedding remains one of the top threats to Canadian public safety, he said. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi described Wedding's drug operation as one of the most prolific and violent trafficking organizations in the world. Wedding worked closely with the Sinaloa cartel to flood not only American but Canadian communities with cocaine coming from Colombia, Bondi said, adding that the group shipped approximately 60 metric tons into Los Angeles from Mexico each year. According to a news release from the U.S. Treasury Department, Paredkar introduced Wedding to the traffickers who have been shipping his cocaine. Paredkar is also accused of taking payment to let Wedding eavesdrop on his communications with other clients, several of whom Wedding wished to murder. Paredkar was paid with luxury watches and additional fees, the department said. Paredkar made a brief court appearance in Toronto extradition court on Wednesday morning, appearing via Zoom from a video room at the Toronto South Detention Center. His lawyer, Ravin Fillet, declined to comment when reached by the Star. The allegations against Paredkar have not been tested in the Canadian courts, which will be tasked with evaluating his extradition to the U.S. The veteran defense lawyer has worked on a number of high-profile cases, including representing convicted killer Dallin Millard, who is serving a life sentence for murdering Laura Babcock and Tim Basma. Excuse me. On social media, Paradkar often bragged about his successes in drug charges, posting under his Instagram handle, @cocaine_lawyer. As of Wednesday, the Instagram account has been disabled. The U.S. Department of Justice added that an immigration action is also being launched against his 27-year-old daughter, lawyer Madeline Paradkar, who is living in Chicago. The Justice Department did not detail any specific connection between his daughter and the ongoing wedding case. Court records also name Toronto jeweler Roland Sokolovsky as one of wedding's two chief money launderers. The other was identified as a former Italian Special Forces member. Authorities allege the 37-year-old used his downtown Toronto jewelry business, Diamond Czar, as a front to move massive amounts of cryptocurrency for the wedding criminal organization. Individual payments included a pair of transfers via the crypto stablecoin Tether worth $20 and $48 million. Acevedo Garcia was shot dead in broad daylight in Medellin, Colombia on January 31. As previously reported by the Star, the Montreal native had been set to be the key witness in the sprawling FBI prosecution against Wedding and his organization. The case included secretly monitored meetings with Wedding, his right-hand man, and other co-conspirators in Mexico, Canada, and Dubai. Wedding allegedly placed a bounty on the witness's head in the erroneous belief that his death would result in the dismissal of criminal charges against him and stop his extradition to the U.S., Aseli said. He was wrong. Court documents filed in a Montreal courthouse and obtained by the Star detail how Wedding worked with Paradkar and a team of hitmen. The U.S. indictment refers to them as sicarios, including alleged Montreal crime figure Atna Anha, 40, to lure Acevedo Garcia to his death. Anha was arrested by the RCMP on Tuesday and is also facing extradition. According to the FBI, the killing also involved a Canadian crime blog called The Dirty News. Operator and co-founder Gurswick Singh Bal, 31, was allegedly paid by Wedding's co-defendant to post a photograph of the witness and his wife online so that they could be hunted down and killed. The site presented as a gossipy blog about crimes in the GTA and across Canada, including stories about organized crime figures and homicide cases linked to Wedding. The posts would often contain details and photographs that had never been made public. According to the indictment, Ball was paid approximately $10,000 to make the post so that Wedding's associates could locate and kill the witness. On the website's group chat, on the messaging app Telegram, Ball's account later posted, "Ryan Wedding paid us the most out of any gangster or leader that we've dealt with. They gave us $10,000, the post continued, adding a fire emoji. The U.S. Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney's Office and the FBI have since seized the website. The homepage is now replaced by a notice, including a logo of a snowboarder and the name of the investigation, Operation Giant Slalom. Ball of Mississauga is facing several offenses, including conspiracy to commit murder and conspiracy to tamper with a witness. If convicted, Wedding and the other defendants charged in the murder conspiracy, including Paradkar, Ball, and Onha, face a maximum sentence of life in federal prison. It was a little more than a year ago that U.S. authorities unsealed the first indictment against Wedding and 15 others for running a cross-border drug trafficking operation that moved massive quantities of cocaine from California to Canada via GTA-based long-haul trucks. Wedding is believed to be hiding in Mexico. He and his alleged right-hand man, Canadian Andrew Clark, 35, are alleged to have ordered a series of assassinations to protect the organization. Authorities have publicly linked them to 4 killings in Ontario, but said on Wednesday that Wedding is suspected of orchestrating several more. Clark was arrested in Mexico last year and remains in U.S. custody. Wedding, said to go by aliases that include El Jefe and Public Enemy, finished 24th in the men's parallel giant slalom at the 2002 Olympics in Salt Lake City. He has been on the run since at least 2014, when he was named in a 2-year RCMP investigation targeting several plots to import cocaine into Canada. The former athlete is allegedly responsible for the brutal slayings of an Indian couple and Caledon who were mistakenly targeted by a gunman in retaliation for stolen drugs. The shooting on November 20, 2023, killed Jagtar Singh Sidhu, 57, and his wife Harbhajan Kaur Sidhu, 55, and left their daughter, Jaspreet Kaur Sidhu, critically injured. The gunmen in the attack have not yet been caught. Among other things, Paradkar is also accused of sending screenshots of the OPP's evidence on the Caledon murders to Clark. U.S. officials also allege that Wedding and Clark are responsible for ordering the slaying of a 39-year-old Brampton man in May 2024. Clark and another Canadian, 24-year-old Malik Cunningham, are separately charged in the April 1, 2024 killing of 29-year-old Randy Fader in Niagara Falls. U.S. authorities have said that Fader was known to Canadian police to be involved in international drug trafficking, but his family disputes this. These killings are being charged in the U.S. because the FBI alleges the killing was done in the furtherance of a U.S. criminal organization. Wedding is believed to have ordered dozens of murders around the world. John Hurley, Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence at the U.S. Treasury Department, said Wednesday. Okay, I'm going to pause just here right now to remind you that you're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And the next article from the front page is under the byline Trade War, and it is titled, Fighter Jet Purchase to Affect Future Talks. Ambassador urges Canada to harmonize on range of U.S. economic military issues. It's by Tonda McCharles. Ottawa. The future of Canada-U.S. trade talks depends on how Canada's review of its decision to buy U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets turns out, says President Donald Trump's ambassador to Canada. Pete Hoekstra told a conference hosted by the Canadian Manufacturers and Exporters on Wednesday that it will not be easy to restart the now stalled trade talks and urged Canada to harmonize as much as possible with the U.S. on a range of economic and military cooperation issues. Hoekstra acknowledged a framework for free trade already exists in the form of the Canada-U.S.-Mexico Agreement, which is up for review next year. but when asked to describe how he sees the next iteration of that trade agreement shaping up, Hoekstra was characteristically blunt. Well, on a number of these issues, we're actually waiting to see exactly where the Canadian government is going to come out on this, he said, pointing directly to the F-35 purchase review and questioning what it means that Canada is shopping elsewhere for its fighter jets and seeking to make its defense industrial base less reliant on the U.S. Hoekstra's comments came a day after Industry Minister Melanie Joly told reporters the current F-35 contract doesn't provide adequate jobs or other economic benefits to Canada. We believe that we didn't get enough when it comes to the F-35, Joly said Tuesday. The industrial benefits are not enough. There needs to be more jobs created out of the F-35 contract. That's clear to me and clear to this government. She added, the government believes it can use military procurement to get more. Joly was speaking as the Carney government engages in talks to possibly buy Swedish Gripen E fighter jets as part of its quest to wean Canada off its over-reliance on the U.S. Under the F-35 deal Canada signed with U.S.-based Lockheed Martin, Ottawa agreed to buy 16 of the jets with an option to purchase up to 88. But Joly underscored that Sweden-based Saab is promising to create 10,000 jobs. It's not an American plane, it's an international plane, he said. Hoekstra noted that Saudi Arabia yesterday bought about $5 billion worth of F-35s. Adding, that means a significant amount of money to a lot of Canadian companies. He also flagged concerns about what Canada's review of its defense industrial capacity means for the Canada-U.S. relationship, which he said has long benefited from an integrated supply chain and the NORAD agreement under which they share continental defense. It's American-Canadian investment. It's on Canadian soil. It's all Canadian workers, he said. Is that a Canadian product or not? For U.S. purposes, when Canada, a Canadian supplier, military supplier, ships product to the U.S., we consider that American content. Hoekstra pointed to an agreement between the U.S., Finland, and Canada, signed this week that takes steps toward jointly building Arctic icebreakers as a good model. He said, we're waiting to see whether Canadians confirm and whether Ottawa still supports the interoperability, and joint operations that have really defined this relationship over the last 50 years. Hoekstra emphasized that Canadians should not expect that if and when trade talks resumes, tariffs will be dropped. The president has made it very, very clear there will be a tariff structure between the U.S. and Canada, the ambassador said. Hoekstra then repeated his accusation the Ontario government's anti-tariff advertisement amounted to Canada meddling in U.S. politics ahead of a charged U.S. Supreme Court hearing on tariffs and a handful of state elections. On Wednesday, Hoekstra dismissed the notion it was Ontario, not Canada, that sponsored the ad, saying the U.S. doesn't engage in slicing and dicing, which order of government was responsible. Hoekstra expressed shock that polls show Canadians now see the U.S. as more of a threat than China. He said Canada and the U.S. should deepen cooperation, and Ottawa should align its trade policies with Trump's in order to shut out cheaper Chinese-made products such as steel. Gabriel Brunet, spokesman for Canada-U.S. Trade Minister Dominic LeBlanc, in a written reply did not address the Star's questions about whether the U.S. has formally notified Ottawa the Trump administration has tied the F-35 review to the restart of stalled talks on tariffs or to the future of the review of the Canada-US-Mexico trade deal. And the next article from the front page is under the byline of gun buyback. Liberals see low uptake in initial stage of rollout. Feds review results in NS after pushback, by Mark Ramsey. The Liberal government refused Wednesday to say how many banned weapons have been collected in the trial for its contentious gun buyback program, as federal sources and local reports suggest minimal success, raising concerns about how the roughly $750 million scheme will unfold on a national scale. The Liberals kick-started the long-delayed program with Cape Breton, NS, as its testing ground last month, hoping to collect 200 guns and evaluate its system. But the small-scale pilot has been met with pushback and little uptake from frustrated gun owners. An RCMP official who was granted anonymity as they were not authorized to speak publicly confirmed this week that uptake was below hopes and expectations. Local media reports from CBC and the Cape Breton Post have cited Glenn Perruque, the chair of the Cape Breton Police Board, as saying he's heard between 10 and 22 guns were collected, which would be less than 50% of Ottawa's stated target. Perruque did not reply to a request for comment from the Star on Wednesday. Public Safety Minister Gary Anandesangari would only say that government was analyzing the results and would be sharing the data at the appropriate time. By all accounts, technical capabilities have been satisfied, and we are looking forward to rolling out the program across Canada over the coming weeks, Anandesangari told reporters. But Natalie Provost, the Secretary of State for Nature and a longtime gun control advocate, acknowledged this week there was a low uptake, telling the Star she was concerned about it. She added, however, the Cape Breton project, was a valuable learning experience that showed the importance of communication. The program is going well because one of the first issues of the program was to see if the system worked. And so on that aspect, it worked well, said Provost, a survivor of the 1989 École Polytechnique massacre. The numbers are not very high, but they're very important. We learned so much doing it. It's not yet clear when the national program, which aims to collect more than 2,500 types of firearms banned by the Trudeau government, will start. The pilot project in Cape Breton was launched 6 weeks ago, a day after an audio recording of Anandesangari surfaced, in which the minister suggested to his gun-owning tenant the Carney government was moving forward with the Trudeau-era policy due to electoral pressure from Quebec. He later said those private comments intended to convey his belief that the long-delayed program should have been completed faster. The Alberta and Saskatchewan governments have added roadblocks to taking away their citizens' guns, while signaling more is to come. And some police services, including the Ontario Provincial Police, have said they won't participate. Meanwhile, gun control advocates have grown frustrated about delays in the program and other measures. In a letter to the Prime Minister, Mark Carney, last week, the Police Souviens said it would be disingenuous and even hypocritical for Liberal MPs to wear white ribbons to mark the December 6th anniversary of the Montreal mass shooting. Gun owners in Cape Breton were not required to participate in the pilot project, and can still surrender banned firearms once the national program rolls out. But Rod Giltecca, CEO of the Canadian Coalition for Firearm Rights, called the participation so far a startlingly low number. Giltecca said there could be more noticeable uptake under the threat of criminality, but it seems like people are ready to resist. In Cape Breton, the launch of the pilot project was met with protests from gun owners and condemnation from the local police union. The Cape Breton Post reported that Cape Breton Regional Police Chief Robert Walsh said he had agreed to a request from the federal government not to comment on the results of the pilot project. NN Desangari's office did not address that question when reached by the Star. Two Liberal MPs told the Star they don't think it's politically smart to promote the program to constituents, citing fear of backlash. One of the local Cape Breton MPs, however, said Wednesday it has not really been an issue in his riding. "Haven't heard anything negative about it. People really aren't talking about it," said Liberal MP Jamie Batiste. And the next article is titled, "Ontario to subsidize new appliances to help reduce demand on power grid. Energy efficient machines qualify for $200 rebates." This is by Marco Chown Oved. "New appliances use so much less energy than old ones. The province will soon pay Ontarians hundreds of dollars to upgrade in order to reduce pressure on the provincial energy grid. This fall, checks for $200 will start being sent out to people who upgrade their refrigerator, freezer, or laundry machines to models that are energy efficient," Energy Minister Stephen Leckie announced Wednesday. "By expanding Ontario's energy savings programs to include energy efficient appliances, families save money and Ontario saves power. The ultimate win-win," he said in a statement. "To meet demand for electricity that is projected to skyrocket by 75% by 2050, the province has started construction on the first new nuclear reactors in more than 30 years. But with long construction timelines, the Progressive Conservatives have also brought in a suite of energy efficiency programs to slow that demand growth down." When he was elected in 2018, Premier Doug Ford canceled the previous government's energy savings programs. The province's Home Renovation Savings Program offers homeowners thousands of dollars in rebates to upgrade windows, doors, and insulation, or to install rooftop solar or a heat pump. Administered by Enbridge Gas, the provincial program has become less attractive since the federal government canceled its energy efficiency program, which allowed homeowners to double their rebates. The province said its program has eliminated 226 megawatts of electricity demand during peak periods. Ontario also has the Peak Perks program, which pays people who sign up to have their air conditioning turned down remotely when demand soars, and other industrial programs that subsidize large-scale upgrades in energy efficiency for businesses. Taken together, the programs will cost $10.9 billion and aim to eliminate 3,000 megawatts of demand by 2036. The equivalent of 3 million homes. This is projected to create savings of $23.1 billion in avoided upgrades to the grid that would have otherwise been necessary, the Energy Ministry said in a release. With the refurbishments of Bruce and Darlington nuclear plants ongoing, the costs of expanding Ontario's grid are only starting to be added to hydro bills. residential hydro rates went up 29% on November 1, though the hike was mostly hidden by a near doubling of the Ontario electricity rebate, which subsidizes bills with taxpayer funds. The province now spends an estimated $8.5 billion annually to artificially lower electricity costs for residents. Green Party leader Mike Schreiner welcomed the appliance rebate, saying he's been calling for them for years to help people save money by saving energy, but questioned the electricity rebates since they disproportionately go to the wealthy, who will consume more power. And I need to stop once more to remind you, you're listening to a reading of articles and features for the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And the next article is titled, Exhibition Moves Spark Concern. Province takes control of property, but insists it just wants access to underground infrastructure. And this is by David Ryder and Madis Habibinia. After days of concern, the Premier Doug Ford's government is preparing to annex city-owned Exhibition Place. The province says an unusual legislative move it made this fall is only about accessing pipes and wires, which some elected officials argue still doesn't clear up unanswered questions. After repeated requests Wednesday for clarification of a clause buried deep in the provincial legislation that appears to give Ontario government control of Exhibition Place, as it redevelops neighboring Ontario Place, a spokesperson for Tourism Minister Stan Cho told the Star the province has no takeover plans. The province is confirming this is only about in-ground infrastructure like water pipes, electricity, internet cables, and infrastructure related to construction at Ontario Place, Kelsey Harapstead said, noting that aging infrastructure runs underground between Exhibition Place on the north side of Lakeshore Boulevard West and Ontario Place to the south. Giving the province control over specific sites that include Exhibition Place as part of Bill 68, the Plan to Protect Ontario Act, would allow it access to upgrade the pipes and wires without going through the City of Toronto's permit process. It remains unclear, however, exactly what impact the legislative change will have over future control of 197-acre Exhibition Place, which hosts the annual late summer Canadian National Exhibition, plus many conventions and events, including 6 World Cup soccer games next June 11 to July 19. Councilman Asma Malik, the city's deputy mayor and chair of the Exhibition Place Board, called the province's clarification important, but said Toronto needs more information about why the city site was included in Bill 68. Since neither the city or Exhibition Place was informed in advance, this inclusion does raise serious questions, and the city staff are reviewing closely the facts of what it means, Malik said in an email Wednesday. Exhibition Place is important city property, and any unilateral provincial moves to seize it must be challenged. The Ford government originally agreed to put its controversial Ontario Place revamp, featuring a glass-enclosed mega-spa and water park on waterfront land leased to Therme Canada and an expanded concert venue, through the city's normal rezoning process. However, in October 2024, it abandoned that process in favor of an enhanced minister's zoning order allowing construction to proceed without city approvals. The province similarly broke off months-long talks with the city over locating a parking lot for spa and concert customers on Exhibition Place grounds, announcing last June it plans to build a $400 million five-story parkade at Ontario Place. The Star can report that Therme recently asked officials in Mayor Olivia Chow's office about the possibility of its future customers parking at Exhibition Place if the province's parkade does not open in time. Chow's office rebuffed the request. NDP MPP Chris Glover, who first raised the alarm about the Bill 68 clause last Thursday, accusing the Ford government of quietly seizing control of the Exhibition Place grounds, said late Wednesday that the Rebuilding Ontario Place Act also gave the Ford government the power to access and use water infrastructure at Exhibition Place. This is like the water company threatening to take ownership of your house if you don't let them inside to inspect it. If this is just about water supplies and power lines, why does the Ford government need to take control of the land? Glover said. Bill 68, currently in second reading, proposes bringing a group of properties under the Rebuilding Ontario Place Act, legislation that Glover says allows the premier to override provincial and municipal laws, including heritage protections, environmental safeguards, and labor laws. According to Ontario Land Property Records, the various properties covered by the bill include Exhibition Place grounds with BMO Field and several large parking lots west to where Lakeshore Boulevard meets the Gardiner Expressway. External municipal lawyers with expertise in planning and land use consulted by the Star said Bill 68 appears to amend the Ontario Place Act to take over properties identified as land vested in the Crown, meaning land owned by the provincial government. According to the Rebuilding Ontario Place Act, adding those properties under its purview means they are under the minister's control. Revelations about the clause caused consternation at City Hall. I don't know the details, Chow said late last week, but I do know that we definitely need more cooperation from the provincial government. And the next article is titled, Six Kids and CHEO Get $35 Million for Mental Health Care by Sadine Mohsen. Sick Kids and CHEO have received $35 million to advance youth mental health care with a focus on early diagnosis and targeted treatment. Gifted by the Waverly House Foundation and its founder, Bruce McKean, the donation will be going toward the Precision Child and Youth Mental Health Initiative, a new approach to providing tailored treatments to improve long-term outcomes. McKean, a philanthropist billionaire, has been donating to mental health research and initiatives through Waverly House, a foundation he set up after he became wealthy through Shopify investments. He told the Star wanted to make a difference. I think it meant he wanted to make a difference. The project is a joint partnership between Sick Kids and CHEO, a children's hospital in Ottawa. The donation was released in two phases, an initial phase of $10 million in 2022, which contributed to ongoing research, and $25 million announced Wednesday afternoon. About 1.2 million children and youth in Canada, are affected by mental illness, according to the Mental Health Commission of Canada. In Ontario, about 1 in 5 children and youth have mental health challenges, according to the Canadian Mental Health Association. This gift from Bruce is transformative for youth mental health at SickKids, CHEO, and beyond, said Dr. Jennifer Crosby, clinical psychologist at SickKids and scientific co-lead of the initiative. This new era of precision medicine, helped by the donation, allows researchers and physicians to help choose the right treatment for the right children at the right time. Precision mental health looks at individual variables that are affecting children and youth, such as family background, past stressors, and environment, to help physicians come up with the best treatment. The donation will provide training for experts in precision mental health and identify new interventions for children and youth. Crosby says earlier intervention measures are what usually provide better outcomes for children and youth struggling with their mental health. And the next article is under a subtitle, Queen's Park, Stiles Kicked Out of Legislature. NDP leader slams corrupt Ford government over controversial skills fund. And this is by Rob Ferguson and Maura Welsh. NDP leader Merritt Stiles was ejected from the legislature for calling Premier Doug Ford's government corrupt as tension flare over deepening concerns about payouts from the $2.5 billion Skills Development Fund. In the wake of a STAR report that low-ranked applications from unions and other organizations got more money on average than high-ranked ones, the Liberals also took aim Wednesday at Ford and Labor Minister Dave Piccini. How do you actually score lower and get more if you're not playing golf? Asked MPP John Fraser, Ottawa South. How does that happen? Piccini said the government has robust internal risk assessment processes and strong backstops, including a deputy labor minister with the power to reject applications to ensure funding goes to worthy worker training projects. We're continuing to improve it, he added. Working with our valued ministry officials is not in contradiction. It's something we do together to continue to strengthen integrity of this program. Stiles pushed back during the opening minutes of the legislature's daily question period. The Auditor General confirmed that civil servants were overruled routinely by this minister and his political staff, she said, citing an October 1 special report that found payouts to at least 64 organizations with low-rated applications were not, quote, fair, transparent, or accountable, end quote. It is the endless grift of an anti-democratic and, yes, corrupt government, Stiles charged. Such allegations are considered unparliamentary language, and Stiles was asked by Speaker Donna Skelly to withdraw the comment. When she refused, Stiles was escorted out of the chamber by the sergeant at arms and banned for the rest of the day, missing a final vote as government MPPs used. Used their majority to pass the controversial Bill 33, which gives the province expanded powers over school boards. I'm really fed up, the NDP leader said later. I obviously didn't want to be ejected, but sometimes you've got to do that if you really want to call it what it is. She and other opposition leaders are pushing for an independent investigation of the Skills Development Fund. They want a full examination of how decisions were made to fund applicants, which have included groups that hired lobbyists with progressive, conservative ties and groups that endorsed or donated to Ford's party in the February 27 election that returned him to power with a third consecutive majority. If the Ford government wants to eliminate any appearance of corruption, they should call and agree to a forensic audit so we have transparent and honest answers about how taxpayer dollars are being spent, said Green leader Mike Schreiner. And I must remind you one last time, you are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Toronto Star on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. And now I have an opinion piece by Martin Reg Cohn. Is Ford as tough on crime as he says? Doug Ford wants you to think he's tough on crime. Think again. In truth, accused murderers are going free and hardened criminals are getting softer sentences in Ontario, all on his watch. All because of rampant abuses of inmates at the sprawling Maplehurst Jail complex, enabled and exacerbated by a culture of cover-up and complacency among government authorities who report to the Premier. Now, Ontario judges are calling the Ford government to account, but words alone are not justice, so they are sending a message with verdicts that can no longer be ignored by the Premier or by the public. One after one, accused criminals are going free. Three men on trial for an execution-style murder walked last month after a scathing judgment that shocks the conscience as a consequence of documented abuse over 2 days at the Maplehurst complex, akin to torture, according to Justice Clayton Conlin. A stay was granted and the prosecution collapsed. First came the crime of murder. Then came the criminal abuse of these three men and nearly 200 other inmates over the course of 2 days in December of 2023 that included a violent strip search and collective punishment. Then came the institutional cover-up that compounded the crime with a code of silence among jail staff and video evidence likely intentionally destroyed. In his ruling, the judge makes clear he is painfully aware of the injustice of letting accused murderers go free, but those who are in charge of the justice system must answer for the abuses. Now as many as 35 criminal cases are likely to be tossed, influenced by the devastating findings in Conlin's recent decision. That's in addition to a tally by Star reporter Brendan Kennedy suggesting more than 30 criminal prosecutions have already been compromised, many in plea deals that reduce sentences or probation. What has the Ford government said or done about this? As little as possible. As the cabinet minister responsible for Ontario's jails, Solicitor General Michael Kirzner has remained conspicuously silent in the face of questioning and quiescent in the line of duty. He has declined all interview requests for Kennedy's articles, responding to written questions with anodyne answers while stressing the need to avoid comment while this is before the courts. But the courts have spoken. The latest ruling speaks volumes. A desperate attempt by a judge to get the minister and the premier to answer for the abuses and act against future transgressions. Excuse me. This is the scandal that got away. While Ford's Tories are plagued by boondoggles that attract opposition attention daily, this one has gained little traction, which perhaps explains the inattention and inaction by those in authority. Possibly our politicians believe ordinary voters care little for criminal suspects awaiting trial, but judges do, and we all should. Cruel and unusual punishment crosses a line. Abuse that is akin to torture cannot go unpursued and unpunished, which is precisely why judges are letting criminals go free, so that politicians and the public will pay attention. At a news conference earlier this year, Ford said he couldn't countenance the abuse. Everyone should be treated fairly. You know, even though they're criminals, we got to treat them like humans. But I'll pass this over to the Solicitor General. Kirshner's response: the matter is subject to an investigation, and my expectation is that everyone that keeps us safe has to uphold the highest standards of professional conduct, and when they don't, there will be consequences. Precisely what, after 2 years, he won't say. But the judge drew his own conclusions about the lack of follow-up and the institutional rot that remains. His ruling noted the lack of effort in determining how key video evidence went missing, the lack of consequences after inmates were forced to sit in their underwear for up to 2 days in colder temperatures after their hands were zip-tied and they were subjected to a purely punitive strip search. Most importantly, he called out the failure to forestall a recurrence in future. No directives from management, no policy changes, nothing, Conlin wrote in his judgment. No reprimands for staff who falsified reports and lied to internal investigators, also under oath in court. The verdicts are in by failing to reform provincial jails where inmates are subject to abuse, and then when early release from the courts, the Solicitor General has failed in his most fundamental duty to keep accused criminals off the streets. Ford's mantra since winning power on a law and order platform has been to demand less bail and more jail for accused criminals, knowing that this would produce even more overcrowding in Ontario's underfunded correctional institutions. Yet for all his public demands for federal bail reform, his own provincial bailiwick cries out for reform. The government has a duty of custodial care for those in custody. Before the premier promises to get tough on crime in the streets, he needs to crack down on criminal abuses within his own government facilities. Justice demands that Ford finally remedy the scandalous inaction from his own cabinet minister by replacing him and reforming the correctional system before another judge delivers another devastating verdict. And the next article is titled, Ottawa Wants BC's Support for Oil Pipeline. However, spokesperson for Resource Minister says government won't give province a veto. This is by Alex Ballingall and Ryan Tamilty. Ottawa. The federal government is willing to support a new oil pipeline to the West Coast, but wants any such project to have British Columbia's backing before it goes forward, says Natural Resources Minister Tim Hodgson. For it to go through a jurisdiction, you need the support of the jurisdiction, Hodgson told the Star on Wednesday. Carolyn Svonkin, a spokesperson from Hodgson's office, later clarified that the government will not confer a veto to British Columbia over development of the pipeline. Instead, she said the Carney government's strong preference is for a new pipeline to have British Columbia's support, especially if it is to be eligible for fast-track approval under a new process for national interest projects, as Alberta Premier Danielle Smith has demanded. The position differs from the views of several Liberal MPs, including former Natural Resources Minister Jonathan Wilkinson, who said Wednesday that any new oil pipeline through British Columbia should require the support of the province and significant Indigenous support. The comments came as talks progressed toward a new accord between the federal government and oil-rich Alberta on climate and energy policies. Prime Minister Mark Carney has previously suggested the discussion could lead to a new oil pipeline as part of a grand bargain that would see measures advanced to slash the fossil fuel sector's greenhouse gas emissions, including stronger industrial carbon pricing, methane regulations, and construction of the Pathways Alliance Carbon Capture Project. A pipeline to the British Columbia North Coast would also require Ottawa to change or lift the regional ban on oil tanker traffic against the wishes of British Columbia Premier David Eby and a group of local First Nations. Hodgson refused to reveal any details about discussions with Alberta. After the Globe and Mail reported a new climate and energy deal could include a pipeline to British Columbia's northwest coast. But he said the federal government supports talks between British Columbia and Alberta, as the United Conservative Administration in Edmonton champions a $14 million study for a proposal to bring oil from Alberta to the British Columbia coast at either Kitimat or Prince Rupert. If Premier Smith and Premier Eby want to talk about that and find a way to make it work, we'll be there to be supportive, Hodgson said. Hodgson said the federal government is also seeking an improvement to Alberta's industrial carbon capture system and a commitment to the Pathways Carbon Capture Project. The Pathways proposal is a 400-kilometer-long pipeline that would take greenhouse gases from the oil sands and sequester them underground. It's been proposed by the country's largest oil sands companies and has been referred to the federal government's new major projects office for review. Hodgson said it's a potentially game-changing project and a necessity for a new oil pipeline. What I think Premier Smith accepts is before any pipelines get built anywhere, we need to see pathways built, which would fundamentally decarbonize an entire industry, he said. Some Liberal MPs, however, cast doubt on the prospect of a new oil pipeline through British Columbia. Wilkinson said lifting the oil tanker ban to allow a new oil pipeline could risk jeopardizing support from local Indigenous communities for liquefied natural gas, that's LNG, export developments, a major new industry that Carney government has championed. Much of the support for the LNG facilities that are going there relies on the support of coastal First Nations, he said. I think that's a risk. And unfortunately, I can't finish the article, but I think you got the gist of it there. I'm going to end with, you have been listening to a reading of articles and features from the November 20 issue of the Toronto Star. Your reader has been Jane. Thank you for listening.